we are aware of their condition, and when we are providing them a profitability, when we are giving them some gifts, it should be in a way that they become free of need. And this way we are taking care of them so that the people who are living around us, they feel secure and they feel free of need. And this way we can have a peaceful life in that place where we are living, and we can have peaceful neighbors, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is the Heart of Life pounding IRIB English Radio.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
A 21-gun salute was performed in the honor of the Iranian president as Oman's Sultan Haitham bin Tariq received Ibrahim Raisi, who was on a one-day visit to the Persian Gulf country. The high-ranking delegations representing the two countries held discussions before the meeting between the two heads of state was held. Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, was also among the high-ranking delegation. He met with his Omani counterpart, Said Badr al-Busaidi, on Monday. The Iranian president said dialogue and cooperation among regional nations would create security, noting that the presence of foreign forces not only won't serve to secure the region, but will threaten peace too.
I think first and foremost, it's important to highlight that it's significant that the first visit for the Iranian president, Ibrahim Raisi, to the to the neighboring countries is to Oman. Oman is renowned as the Switzerland, if you like, of the region, a country that enjoys good ties with everyone, a country that tries to stay neutral, a country that tries to be the facilitator and mediator in a number of contentious issues. And Oman has strived to maintain these ties, whether it's with Saudi Arabia, with Iran, with UAE, with Qatar, across the entire spectrum. And this is what leads many to believe that this visit by Iran to Oman is testament, of course, one, to this ability of Gulf states to have good ties with Iran, and two, as a model through which Gulf states can have ties with Iran and which Iran can have ties with Gulf states, a relationship that respects the integrity of one another, and in a relationship that boosts economic ties, and a relationship that tries to promote dialogue first and foremost, as opposed to trying to settle scores.
Ibrahim Raisi further welcomed what he called Tehran and Muscat's remarkably similar stance on a multitude of matters. The Iranian president hailed the visit as one that opened a new chapter in the bilateral relations between Iran and Oman. An Iranian delegation of 50 tradesmen and economic operators traveled to Oman last week in order to pave the way for the development of economic and trade ties between the two friendly countries. Iranian Minister of Road and Urban Development, Rostam Qasemi, announced that Oman and Iran are going to sign a transportation agreement in order to establish a joint shipping line and tourist flights between the two countries. The two sides signed 13 documents and memoranda of understanding in such fields as energy, politics, transportation, diplomacy, economy, tourism, sports, and the environment. Oman is also seeking to import gas from Iran by building an offshore pipeline between the two nations.
Renew Iranian access to the global economy. And part of that, or part of the Iranian considerations, is to find a reliable partner that it trusts in order to help to facilitate that re-access or rehabilitation into the international markets. And Oman, being a country that is particularly trusted by Iran, that has good ties with Iran, that has proven time and time again, or rather this relationship has proven time and time again, to be a steady relationship between Oman and Iran. Iran wants to utilize Oman's unique position in the region, not just in terms of its strategic location, but also with regards to its international free trade agreements, with which Oman enjoys even with the likes of the United States. The idea being that Oman is a good hub through which to essentially propel Iranian goods or Iranian businesses or Iranian investments, or even to receive investments from abroad via Oman, via a trusted partner.
Iran and Oman have agreed to form a committee to jointly develop the Hengam oil field, which straddles both countries' sea borders. In 2005, both countries signed a memorandum of understanding to jointly develop the Hengam oil field, but the agreement did not materialize. This is why the Iranian president said the trip marked a departure, as the documents and memorandum of understanding will be implemented this time.
The Labour victory ends nearly a decade of conservative rule in Australia. Minister Scott Morrison conceded defeat after an election on Saturday, and the opposition Labour Party was set to end almost a decade of conservative rule, possibly with the support of pro-environment independents. Anthony Albanese says he wants to make Australia greener and less hawkish. He said he wanted to unite the country. He told his supporters, "I think people want to come together. Look for our common interest, look towards that sense of common purpose. I think people have had enough of division. What they want is to come together as a nation, and I intend to lead that." Labour has secured a parliamentary majority in general elections, but Albanese may still need a coalition partner to rule. He has indicated that they'll be picked from like-minded independents. The new Labour government promises to reset Australia's relations with the world. Albanese has also promised to create stronger ties with Asia. He said, "We live in a region whereby in the future we will have China, India, and Indonesia as giants. We need to strengthen that economic partnership, and one way that we can do that is by strengthening people-to-people relations as well." Labour has promised more financial assistance and the robust social safety net as Australia grapples with the highest inflation since 2001 and soaring housing prices. The party also plans to increase minimum wages. Others will be watching closely to see if Albanese's premiership brings a less hawkish tone on China, and whether ministerial meetings with Beijing resumes after a more than two-year hiatus. On the foreign policy front, it has proposed to establish a Pacific Defense School to train neighboring armies in response to China's potential military presence on the Solomon Islands. In late April, the Solomon Islands signed a security pact with China. The outgoing Australian leader was highly critical of China in particular and Asian countries in general. He had earlier accused his main opponent of being Beijing's preferred candidate. Relations between China and Australia have strained since 2018, when Australia became the first country to ban the Chinese telecom giant Huawei from its 5G wireless networks. Australia has long been known as the lucky country, partly due to its wealth of coal and gas, as well as minerals like iron ore, which have driven generations of economic growth. But it's now sitting on the frontier of a climate crisis, and the fires, floods, and droughts that are expected to become more extreme due to the rising global temperatures. Labour wants to tackle climate change with an ambitious 43% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2030. It also has pledged to reach emission net zero by 2050, partly by strengthening the mechanism used to pressure companies to make cuts. To speed up the transition to renewable energy, Labour plans to modernize Australia's energy grid and roll out solar banks and community batteries. But despite its net zero commitment, Labour says it'll approve new coal projects if they're environmentally and economically viable. The Conservative government had been called a climate holdout by the United Nations Secretary General after outlining a plan to get to net zero by 2050 by creating massive new gas projects. Incumbent Scott Morrison had said he would back a transition from coal to renewable energy, but had no plans to stop new coal projects.
Oh, the legacy is awful. We have the worst climate change policies on the planet, courtesy of this government. They were promoting new coal mines. A huge part of their argument was we had to open up more mines as fast as possible. So it was, you know, crashing headlong into climate change and denying any role in it. Foreign policy was a joke.
Elena Doohan, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of unilateral coercive measures on the enjoyment of human rights, who was on a mission to Iran from May 7th to 18th, has described U.S. sanctions on Iran as unjustifiable and inhumane.
Iran has been subjected to a broad scope of unilateral sanctions for a long period of time already. In particular, the United States has imposed economic, trade, and financial sanctions on Iran since the late 1970s, with a comprehensive trade ban since 1995, and measures to isolate Iran from the international commercial and financial system. These were expanded in mid-2000, and again after 2010, extending to many economic sectors.
U.S. sanctions also targeted Iran's central bank as well as commercial banks. The EU adopted restrictive measures and comprehensive economic and trade sanctions against Iran in 2010, supplemented by an oil embargo in 2012, and trade prohibitions involving key sectors and the freezing of assets of the Iranian central bank, Iranian shipping and shipbuilding sector, and a number of persons and entities, and restrictions on financial services, as well as exports and imports. In May 2018, Washington unilaterally withdrew from the JCPOA, under which the international sanctions on the Islamic Republic were eased in exchange for Tehran putting limitations on certain aspects of its nuclear activities. The U.S. then reinstated harsh economic sanctions on Iran and slapped new ones that barred countries and international firms from working with Tehran. Doohan said the U.S. continues to ban trade and investment in Iran, forcing foreign companies to leave the country for the fear of the sanctions. Many banks and businesses, including pharmaceutical and medical companies around the world, overcomply with sanctions out of fear of potential penalties. The UN rapporteur stated that overcompliance with U.S. sanctions could strip Iranians of their basic rights to health. The top UN human rights official highlighted that applying extraterritorial sanctions on Iranian companies or companies working with Iran is illegal under international law. Doohan added that the sanctions have also hampered Iran's effort to import life-saving medicines due to restrictions on banking transactions.
Human rights in Iran are severely affected by the use of unilateral sanctions. The most close to every single individual sphere is the sphere of health. The situation in Iran is the following, that some medicine are produced domestically. At the same time, the raw materials are imported. And then it comes the issue again of payments, deliveries, the quality of delivered raw materials. When it comes to the rare or severe diseases, there is no possibility to deliver that.
Commenting on Iran's frozen assets abroad, the UN official said the assets estimated to be around $120 billion need to be unblocked. Duhan began her 11-day visit to Iran on May 7th, a day before the fourth anniversary of the U.S. illegal withdrawal from the JCPOA. She also referred to stalled negotiations in Vienna to bring the U.S. back to the JCPOA, urging the signatories and the U.S. to resume the negotiations. In the end, Duhan called on sanctioning states, the U.S. in particular, to abandon their policy of maximum pressure against Iran and other countries. Economic sanctions are the policy tool of choice for the United States to force countries to bend if they don't follow Washington's foreign policy objectives in many cases. Yet they have failed to bring the desired result, as they might generate some meaningful behavioral change in the targeted or sanctioned country about 40% of time.
We know that sanctions really don't work as far as convincing or having leaderships of different countries change their decision-making or their behavior. So I think over the years we've learned that nothing's going to change with the continued sanctions.
Unilateral sanctions have endangered the humanitarian situation and people's livelihood in Iran, while further affecting the vulnerable strata of the society. In sanctioned countries like Iran, Venezuela, Cuba, Syria, and Yemen, medical equipment is rather outdated, and they suffer shortages of medicine and protective means. One of the reasons is that payment systems are not available to buy and have medicine enter the respective countries. For instance, Iran was the scene of a serious economic and health crisis, hit hard by the coronavirus pandemic. The embargo put in place by the United States threatened the lives of many Iranians. In what has been termed economic terrorism, Washington attempts to use sanctions as a leverage to overthrow the legitimate governments of other countries, something it has done in the case of Venezuela and Cuba. Whether direct or indirect, most of the U.S. sanctions are not authorized by the United Nations Security Council, and many of them are imposed unilaterally by Washington. In fact, more than two-thirds of the world's countries officially condemn U.S. sanctions as a blatant violation of international law and the UN Charter.
On Thursday, leaders of Sweden and Finland, two European nations that opted for neutrality for years, flanked U.S. President Joe Biden while he threw his support behind their bid to join the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, at the White House.
And today I'm proud to assure them that they have the full, total, complete backing of the United States of America. Today, my administration is submitting to the United States Congress reports on NATO accession for both countries, so the Senate can efficiently and quickly move on advising and consenting to the treaty.
I don't think those nations really ought to be scared of Russia. That would be really stupid if they were. Maybe they are that foolish and believe the narrative going on. I think it's more there's a power play. I mean, you look at the sanctions, that's where you really see the intent. And President Biden said this in Poland. He said, we intend that Russia's economy will be half of what it was over years. So that reveals he's planning to continue this for years. Zelensky, even if he were inclined to negotiate, will not be allowed to do it. And I think there's an intent to force governments to pick sides.
The move comes amid objections by Turkey, a NATO ally, and warnings by Russia. Ankara opposes Finland's and Sweden's accession to the military alliance, citing their longtime support for groups Turkey deems terrorists. Moscow, however, has warned of retaliation if Finland, a country that shares a 1,340-kilometer-long border with Russia, joins NATO. Russia's deputy UN representative, Dmitry Polyansky, went so far as to say that the two nations could turn into potential targets for Russia if they become NATO members. Finland and Sweden say they decided to join the NATO and reverse decades of military non-alignment after Russia attacked Ukraine. But Russia considers NATO's eastward expansion a threat to its national security. The issue was a critical reason Russian officials say pushed Moscow to launch its military operation in Ukraine in February. As the war between Ukraine and Russia entered its fourth month, the U.S. Senate passed a $40 billion bill to provide assistance to Ukraine. 86 senators voted for the bill, while 11 others, all Republicans, voted against it, citing its high price tag and the fact that it might not be offset. The bill earmarks $6 billion for arms to be purchased from contractors and sent to Ukraine. It also increases the presidential drawdown capacity from the $5 billion the Biden administration had originally requested to $11 billion. The drawdown capacity allows the president to send away arms and military equipment directly from U.S. stocks at times of emergency.
It used to be the case when you had votes for sanctions against Russia, it would only be two senators voting against. So I think the revolt against this policy is growing. And I can tell you from the campaigning I've been doing and speaking with hundreds of American voters, Americans do not want this war. They don't support spending all this money on weapons. They may not have a completely elevated view of it, but their inclination is to say, we are suffering here. We're paying $1 million a gallon for gasoline. We're running out of baby formula. Why are we doing this? And I want that to be known around the world that the American people are not represented by the policies of this administration.
The war and the subsequent sanctions on Russia have sent shockwaves across the globe, threatening the most vulnerable economies in the world that have yet to recover from the economic fallout of the COVID-19 pandemic. It's also creating a new global crisis, food shortages.
This is not just about Ukraine. This is about the poorest of the poor around the world who are on the brink of starvation as we speak.
The whole world, including the U.S. and its allies, is paying the price for the war and its ensuing events. The situation would only get worse if the conflict continues indefinitely. The economic, political, and military pressures against Moscow don't seem to contribute to any compromise from the Russian side. The U.S. has expressed its opposition to a prolonged war, but actions speak louder than words.
The Last Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah. To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is The Last Savior. I am your humble host, Zainab. Today in our studio, we have with us Islamic researcher, Dr. Karimi. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome to our program. In the previous session, we discussed so many narrations from Sunni scholars who had quoted from Abu Huraira or Abdullah ibn Mas'ud saying that when Imam Mehdi, ajallaha ta'ala farajahum, will come, he'll fill the world with justice, and until and unless he won't come, the world will not come to an end. Well, today we want to discuss some of the narrations. We discussed the narrations from these two companions. Are there any more Sunni narrations in this regard?
Sure. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So we are talking about the narrations in Sunni sources, which talk about the fact that the Holy Prophet has said regarding Imam Mahdi that his name is like my name. But they do not refer to the name of his father.
His father.
Because Ibn Taymiyyah claims that according to some narrations, his father's name is like the Prophet's father's name, that is Abdullah.
Abdullah.
But we want to prove that, no, many Sunni scholars, they have quoted
narrations
from different companions of the Prophet, which are exactly like the narration in Shia sources.
All right.
Without reference to the father's name. And that is why I'm quoting from different people to show that how many are these narrations.
Yeah.
So as you mentioned, we quoted the narrations which are quoted from Abdullah bin Mas'ud and Abu Huraira. The third one, the third companion of the Prophet, is Hudhaifa bin Yaman. He has also quoted one narration from the Prophet in which the Holy Prophet says, "Ismuhu ismi," his name is like my name.
My name.
And he doesn't refer to that claim that his father's name is
like that
Abdullah.
Of my father's name.
And according to this narration, then Salman Farsi, he stood up and said, "Min ayyi wulik," O the Prophet of God, Mahdi is from which of your children?
True.
And according to this narration, the Holy Prophet says, "Huwa min wuldi hada," from this child of mine, وَضَرَبَ بِيَدِهِ عَلَى الْحُسَيْنِ, and he put his hand on Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam.
Right.
Referring to the fact that Imam Mahdi is from the offsprings of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. This is another companion of the Prophet, quoting this narration. We can find it in many Sunni sources like Iqd al-Durar by Maqdisi al-Shafi'i, 1E1, page 82. Because of the shortage of time, I'm not able to quote all the people who have quoted this narration. I suffice with referring to the name of the companion of the Prophet who is in the chain of the narration.
True.
The fourth one is Abdullah bin Umar, the son of the second caliph. He also has mentioned a narration in which the Holy Prophet says, يَخْرُجُ فِي آخِرُ الزَّمَانِ رَجُلٌ مِّنْ وُلْدِي. In آخِرُ الزَّمَانِ, in end of the times, a man from my children will come. We'll have a kind of uprising. Ismuhu ka ismi, his name is like my name, without referring to the father's name. This is in Iqd al-Durar, 1E1, page 95. Another companion of the Prophet in this regard is Ibn Abbas. He also mentions a narration from the Prophet in which the Holy Prophet only mentions that Yuwato ismuhu ismi, his name is like my name. And also from the next companion of the Prophet in this regard is Abu Sa'id Khidri. According to this narration, Abu Sa'id Khidri says that the Holy Prophet said, "Ismul Mahdi ismi," the name of Mahdi is like my name. And also we have from Imam Ali alayhi salam in this regard many narrations in Sunni sources which are quoted from different people. For example, Abu Dawood Sajistani in his As-Sunan, he narrates the following narration from Imam Ali alayhi salam. In one part of this narration, Imam Ali alayhi salam says that the Holy Prophet said, سَيَخْرُجُ مِنْ صُلْبِهِ رَجُلٌ يُسَمَّى بِسْمِ النَّبِيِّكُمْ. The name of the person who will come in the end of the time is like the name of your Prophet, that is Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his family. So I think these narrations are enough to reject the claim of Ibn Taymiyyah. His claim is that the Shia, they have distorted the narrations by omitting that part of the narration which says that his father's name is like the Prophet's father's name, that is Abdullah. But we see that so many companions of the Prophet, they have quoted the same narration, and many Sunni scholars, they have quoted all these narrations from different companions of the Prophet in their sources. So there is no claim of distortion. Now we go to the next part of the claim. One might say that, okay, we have this version, but according to another version in Sunni sources, the Holy Prophet has said that Ismu Abihi Ismu Abi, his father's name is like my father's name. What about these narrations?
So, Dr. Karimi, for now, we quoted the narrations from different companions of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him. One was Abu Huraira, and then was Ibn Mas'ud, and then Ibn Abbas, and then you said Abu Dawood also narrates from Imam Ali alayhi salam. So, there are a lot of narrations which say, his name will be like my name, but we did not find anywhere saying the narration quoting that his father's name will be like my father's name.
In Shia sources, it's not
mentioned.
It does
not exist at all.
We have some narrations in Sunni sources which have this addition, that Ismu Abi ka Ismu Abi or Ismu Abi. His father's name is like my father's name. That is Abdullah. Yeah.
Dr. Karimi, we'll answer that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIP English Radio.
I can feel your eyes like the sun shining behind the clouds. I need a morning to shatter this long night forever. I need a hero to stop this thousand-year-old
So we said that Ibn Taymiyyah has two claims. The first claim is that Shia have distorted the narration by omitting that part. We proved that no, this is not the case. Because so many Sunni scholars, they have quoted this narration without that part. Is he ready to accept that all these great Sunni scholars, they have distorted the narrations? Of course not. Now we come to the second claim. At the end of the day, we have these narrations in some Sunni sources which have this
part
addition,
there.
This part, that his father's name is Abdullah. So first of all, I mentioned before that as Shia, it's not necessary for us to answer this question because we do not believe in the authenticity of these narrations. None of them has been quoted in Shia sources. But for our dear Sunni brothers and sisters, I would like to prove that even from Sunni perspective, these narrations cannot be relied on. Why? I'll explain from different aspects. The first point is that I'm talking from a Sunni perspective.
Sunni perspective.
We have some narrations in which we have the phrase Ismu Abi ki Ismu Abi, his father's name is like my father's name, it is Abdullah. But the point is that when
their hair is a must analyzation part. We
exactly,
must analyze seasonally.
So the chain of the narration of all these narrations, according to Sunni sources and according to Sunni criteria, is also weak.
All right.
I would like to mention a couple of people in the chain. For example, one of the people who has quoted this narration is a person called Tamim Ad-Dari. He quotes a narration from the Prophet. In one part, the Holy Prophet says, "The days and nights will not come to its end until a person from my progeny will come. Ismuhu ismi, his name is like my name.
My name.
Wa ismu abihi ismu abi, his father's name is like my father's name." Now, it is very interesting that we have great Sunni scholars who themselves, they have mentioned explicitly that this narration is fake, is forged.
All right.
This is not an authentic narration. For example, Ibn Hibban Busti, one of the great Sunni scholars, after quoting this narration, says that لَا يُشَكُّ مِنْ هَذَا الشَّانْ سَنَعَتُهُ أَنَّهَا مَوْضُوعًا. There is no doubt about the fact that this narration is mawdu'. Mawdu' means a narration which is fake, which is forged,
true,
which is not, authentic at all. This is mentioned by At-Tamimi al-Busti in his famous book, Al-Majruhin Min Al-Muhaddithin, Volume 2, page 34. Zahabi, who is a very great Sunni scholar, in his book, Mizan Al-I'tidal, Volume 4, page 106, he also says that it is mawdu'a, it is a forged narration. The
all
same
right
has been mentioned by Suyuti in Al-Masnu'a Fil-Ahadith Al-Mawdu'a. This book is about collecting the narrations which are forged, which are fake. Volume 1, page 424. Abu Faraj bin al-Jawzi, he also says that هذا حديث لا يصح عن رسول الله. This hadith is not an authentic narration from the Prophet, and many other people. I'm not going to mention all the names. So this is the first narration from Tamim al-Dari. The Sunni scholars, they themselves have mentioned that this is not an authentic narration. The second person who has been mentioned in the chain of the narration is Muawiyah bin Qurra. He also mentions a narration from the Holy Prophet, according to which the Holy Prophet has said, لَتُمْلَأَنَّ الْأَرْضُ ظُلْمًا وَجَوْرًا, the earth will be filled with injustice and oppression, and then until a man from my progeny will come, إِسْمُهُ إِسْمِي, his name is like my name, and إِسْمُ أَبِيهِ إِسْمُ أَبِي, his father's name is like my father's name.
Alright.
These have been mentioned, for example, by At-Tabarani in Al-Mu'jam al-Kabir, volume 19, page 32. Again, interestingly, some Sunni scholars, they have mentioned that this is a very weak narration. For example, Manawi, the famous Sunni scholar of Hadith in Faidul Qadir, volume 5, page 262, he says that this narration from Qurrat ibn Iyas has been quoted from Dawood ibn al-Mihbar from his father, وَكِلَاهُمَا ضَعِيفٌ, both of them are weak. So another Sunni scholar refers to the fact that this narration is not authentic. Weak. Other people in the chain are also weak, like Ahmad ibn Muhammad, like Dawood ibn Mihbar, Mihbar ibn Qahdam, and so on and so forth. So this is the second person quoting this narration. The third person who has quoted this narration is Abu Tufail. He quotes from the Prophet that Al-Mahdi ismuhu ismi, wa ismu abihi ismu abi. Mahdi, his name is like my name, and his father's name is like my father's name. Again, when it comes to the chain, we have a couple of people in the chain who are weak, according to Sunni criteria, like Abdullah bin Luhay'a and Maymun al-Qaddah. Quickly, let me refer to another chain, which is quoted from Abdullah bin Mas'ud. In one of the chains, we have Alqama bin Qais and Ubaidah Salmani, and a couple of people in the chain are weak. And also from, Asim has quoted it from Zir ibn Hubaysh, from Abdullah bin Mas'ud. In it, again, we have a couple of people who are weak. We prove that there are some authentic narrations in Sunni sources in which we have only the first part
of the story.
And the second part is not mentioned. We mentioned that Tirmidhi has quoted this narration, and he says that هذا حديث حسن صحيح. This is an authentic narration. When it comes to the second group of the narrations, we cannot find even one narration with authentic chain of the narration.
True.
So even if we want to analyze these narrations from a Sunni perspective, based on Sunni criteria, we cannot rely on the second group of the narrations, and we need to rely only on the first category of the narration, according to which the Holy Prophet only has mentioned that his name is like my name. He doesn't refer to the name of his father.
So, Dr. Karimi, we discussed a number of narrations wherein we discussed the narrations from the companions of Prophet Muhammad from the Sunni sources, obviously. Then we analyzed them in two parts. The first part was where the fact was only mentioned that his name is like my name. There was not the mention of the father's name. And then when it talks about Imam, it says his name is like my name and his father's name is like my name. And interestingly, the Sunni scholars themselves reject the claim and say the chain of narrations is quite weak. And interestingly, Sunni scholars say that this claim is not true, and it's about the chain of narrations on analyzing was quite weak. Thank you so much, Dr. Karimi, for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
In the decades since smallpox vaccination ended, the proportion of people protected against monkeypox has fallen substantially, allowing the virus to spread more easily from animals into humans and from person to person, fueling the risk of a major outbreak. We now present you an article written jointly by Ian Sample and Nicola Davis. The piece is titled, "Scientists Say Monkeypox Outbreak Was Waiting to Happen." Scientists say the unprecedented surge in monkeypox cases in the United Kingdom and beyond was an outbreak waiting to happen after the end of global smallpox vaccination more than 40 years ago. The UK Health Security Agency announced a further 14 cases in England on Tuesday, 24th of May, bringing the total to 70, and one further patient in Scotland. No cases have been identified in Wales or Northern Ireland. Routine smallpox vaccination wound down in most countries before 1980, when the World Health Assembly declared the disease eradicated. Because the vaccine also protects against monkeypox, the campaign had kept that disease in check too, notably in regions of Central and Western Africa, where the virus is endemic. In the decades since smallpox vaccination ended, the proportion of people protected against monkeypox has fallen substantially, allowing the virus to spread more easily from animals into humans and from person to person, fueling the risk of a major outbreak. Dr. Romulus Brebon, a researcher at the Pasteur Institute in Paris, said, "This outbreak was really waiting to happen. For example, mathematical modelling by Brebon and his team in 2020 found that in the Democratic Republic of Congo, immunity to monkeypox fell from 85% in the early 1980s to just 60% in 2012. He wrote, at the time, with declining immunity, monkeypox posed an ever-increasing threat for health security. In 2020, the Democratic Republic of Congo had more than 4,000 suspected cases of monkeypox and at least 171 deaths. Dr. Romulus Brebon said, "Our immunity level is almost zero. People aged 50 and above are likely to be immune, but the rest of us are not. So we are very, very susceptible." He believes the outbreak can be contained and said it was an opportunity to propose vaccination campaigns in countries where the virus is endemic. Until this year, only a handful of cases of monkeypox had ever been spotted in the United Kingdom, all linked to travel from Nigeria. Since the first UK case of 2022 was announced on 7th of May, nearly 300 suspected or confirmed cases have come to light in at least 16 countries. The surge in cases has raised questions about whether the monkeypox virus has evolved into a more transmissible form. So far, scientists have found no evidence for this being the case, but researchers are studying the DNA to see if mutations in the virus may have changed its behavior. Genetic studies so far suggest the virus matches strains that reached the United Kingdom, Singapore, and the occupied Palestinian territories in 2018 and 2019. Professor David Heyman, a distinguished fellow at Chatham House's Global Health Programme, said the outbreak appeared more of a chance event, with the virus being amplified once it got into a community of men. Graham Medley, a professor of infectious disease modelling at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, said there was unlikely to be the same explosive growth of infections into the general population that was witnessed with COVID-19. but he said the outbreak could continue for several months, as contact tracing slows but does not stop transmission. He said, as with COVID, we can expect twists and turns as monkeypox outbreaks continue. At the moment, the transmission chains are mostly within younger men, but there are other settings where there is sufficient contact for monkeypox to spread. The longer the outbreak continues and the higher the prevalence, the more likely the monkeypox will find these other niches. Researchers in Britain have revealed promising yet tentative signs that an antiviral may help to reduce illness from the virus. In a study published in The Lancet Infectious Diseases, 4 of 7 patients diagnosed with monkeypox in the United Kingdom between 2018 and 2021 were given either brincidofovir or tecovirimat, drugs developed to treat smallpox. Findings from the 3 patients given brincidofovir suggest the drug provided little clinical benefit and did not appear to reduce the duration of the illness. However, the 1 patient treated with tecovirimat had a shorter hospital stay and appeared to shed the virus detected by PCR tests for a shorter period of time. Dr. Hugh Adler, the co-author of the study at Liverpool University Hospitals NHS Trust, said that although only 1 patient was involved, the result for tecovirimat was a promising signal. Dr. Hugh Adler said, "Now that we're seeing more cases, unexpectedly, we think it's important to share," adding, "This is the sum total of human experience with these drugs and monkeypox so far. Britain has secured a supply of tecovirimat and is offering a smallpox vaccine to close contacts of people diagnosed with monkeypox to reduce the risk of symptomatic infection and severe illness. Sources suggest an extra 20,000 doses of the vaccine have been ordered to add to the UK stock of 5,000.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghodde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Deep insight and firm determination, the most outstanding qualities of Hazrat Hamza. On January 25, 2022, Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, met with the officials of Hazrat Hamza International Conference. This is a part of his speech with the managers of this conference. A personality like Hamza is an unknown personality. who is not well known. The first thing that can be said about that great personality is that he is not truly recognized. Besides, the commander of the faithful, greetings be upon him, mentioned him as well in a narration in Nur al-Thaqalain, which is based on a narration in Al-Khisal. Of course, I saw this narration in Nur al-Thaqalain. I did not look it up in Khisal. In my opinion, this is an important narration. Imam Baqir alayhi salam, greetings be upon him, quotes the commander of the faithful, greetings be upon him, as saying, I made a covenant with God Almighty and His Messenger, me, my uncle Hamza, my brother Ja'far, and my cousin Ubaidah. Of course, it is a long narration and this is only a part of it. Ubaidah ibn Harith, whom no one knows, was one of the three people who fought in the beginning challenge during the Battle of Badr. Later on, he was martyred too. No one knows him. The commander of the faithful mentions him as well. Me, my uncle Hamza, my brother Ja'far, and my cousin Ubaidah. He says that they made a covenant with God upon an order, and we adhere to it for God and His Messenger. Greetings be upon him and his household.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
They agreed upon an issue and made a deal. The commander of the faithful, as well as his uncle, uncle of the Holy Prophet, that is Hamza, was 2 or 4 years older than the Holy Prophet. And he was also the Holy Prophet's foster brother. The commander of the faithful made a covenant with his uncle, his brother and his cousin over a matter that was naturally jihad until martyrdom. It means that they would continue that path until they were martyred. Afterwards, the commander of the faithful says, And we fulfilled it for God and His Messenger, God's greetings be upon him and his household. But those three overtook me. Those three comrades preceded me in being martyred. I was left behind until God Almighty wanted me. Among the believers are men who have been true to their covenant with God. Of them, some have completed their vow and some still wait. But they have never changed in the least. The commander of the faithful quotes the Holy Quran, chapter 33, verse 23.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me.
In the limelight.
In Britain, details have emerged of what appears to be another alcohol-fueled social event inside number 10 Downing Street during lockdown, one that was seemingly not investigated by the Metropolitan Police or the official civil service investigation. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian journalist Peter Walker. The piece is titled, The Bar is Open. Details emerge of new Downing Street lockdown event. in Britain. New details have emerged of what appears to be another alcohol-fueled social event inside No. 10 Downing Street during lockdown, one that was seemingly not investigated by the Metropolitan Police or the official civil service investigation. According to the British newspaper The Mirror, between 30 and 40 staff drank alcohol and ate takeaway snacks to mark the final press briefing conducted by Boris Johnson's then spokesperson, James Slack, on 17th of November 2020. A photograph obtained by The Mirror appears to show an official setting out bottles of wine and drinks. The picture was reportedly sent to No. 10 Downing Street staff on a WhatsApp group in response to a message saying, "Time to open the COVID-secure bar." The photograph was then posted as a reply with the message, "The bar is open." Other messages reported by The Mirror seemingly demonstrate premeditation in socializing, with one referring to Wine Time Tuesday and others discussing going to buy reinforcement booze. One official said, "If someone can help me carry, I'm happy to go." The alleged event was 4 days after the leaving drinks for Lee Kane, Boris Johnson's head of communications. On Monday, ITV News obtained images showing the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, at the event, raising a glass and seeming to toast Lee Kane and make a speech. Those images have placed pressure on the Metropolitan Police to explain why Prime Minister Boris Johnson was not fined for attending the 13th of November gathering, when others at the gathering were fined. The 17th of November event was not among gatherings investigated by the Metropolitan Police and was not listed among those examined in the interim report into lockdown breaching parties by the senior Cabinet Office civil servant Sue Gray. Sue Gray's full report is expected to emerge this week. James Slack, who was a civil servant rather than a political appointee like Lee Kane, was chosen to replace Kane as head of communications. The 17th of November drinks were held to mark the last time that, as Boris Johnson's official spokesperson, he spoke to the media at the daily lobby briefings, according to reports. At that time, because of the lockdown, the briefings were being held virtually rather than in person. James Slack left No. 10 Downing Street in April of 2021. That leaving party held in the day before Prince Philip's funeral, while indoor social mixing was still barred, was reported and investigated. He is now the deputy editor of The Sun newspaper. Evidence of what appears to be yet another social event, and one planned in advance, puts further pressure on Boris Johnson ahead of Sue Gray's findings, amid reports more Conservative MPs could be submitting letters of no confidence in the Prime Minister. If Sue Gray's full report is released this week, it would most likely be submitted to No. 10 Downing Street in the morning and published shortly afterwards, with Prime Minister Boris Johnson promising to give a statement to Parliament and answer questions from MPs later that day. No. 10 Downing Street has said that Boris Johnson would then aim to hold a press conference. A No. 10 spokesperson said, as part of their investigation, the Cabinet Office team were able to speak to No. 10 staff to establish the facts on what happened during this period. Both they and the Metropolitan Police have had access to all information relevant to their investigations, including photographs. The Metropolitan Police have concluded their investigation, and Sue Gray will publish her report shortly, at which point the Prime Minister will address the Parliament in full. Boris Johnson's former spokesperson, James Slack, was contacted for comment.